Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 27, titled Bliss is Legal.
We have too much rain, actually. And every time it rains nowadays, since Jerry Brown is an old friend of mine, and I have a lot of friends among, I hope I have a lot of friends among you here in California, I feel badly for you. And I wish we could share some of the rain, which we have an excessive amount up the Hudson Valley, you know, it comes up there. But so this is a problem of the global overheating. I always think the global warming expression is a little bit too polite. It's rather overheating. And a global overheating, from Buddhist analysis of the current situation of the world, the global overheating comes from consumerism and out of control consumer industrialization. And, you know, too much enjoyment of consumer things and consumer products and so on. And this pumps this carbon into the atmosphere, methane and so on, and from the terrible agriculture is done and the beef industry and so on. And so it comes from the Buddhist point of view, you know, there are these three poisons that make life intolerable, which are greed, hatred, and delusion. So greed is magnified by consumer industrialization, and it's destroying our lives and our grandchildren's lives and children's lives very, very definitely. And we're not, as a mass, I mean, individuals among us may be taking very strong steps, but and hopefully we are ecologically conscious. I'm sure most of you are, and better than me, I'm sure. But en masse, we're not doing that, and therefore we're ruining the planet in that way, very quickly and dramatically. And then the second thing is militarism, which is another huge disease that we have, which of course is the magnification, technological magnification of hatred. And militarism sucks up a huge amount of world energy and economy, and is very unproductive and very dangerous. And the militarists, who are the governments, who are all our so-called world leaders, are very frustrated actually today. And why we're having a sort of global downturn in the economy has to do with the lack of demand in the economy. You know, that there's more overproduction of things and there's not enough demand. So the normal thing to do would be to have a nice world war and kill a lot of people, destroy a lot of real estate and buildings and things, and then rebuild it all. And then they would continue to make money, and they would sell weapons in the war to all sides, and then they would rebuild everything afterwards and repair it, try to repair it until they needed the next reboot, which is war. But they're very frustrated because they can't have a world war. All they have is a few terrorists who run around, who are not pleasant, I quite agree, but it's not a world war. So you don't make as much money. And then the weapons you send out to various idiots are then taken over by terrorists, and then you have to fight your own weapons, which is good for the weapon makers because then they blow up both directions and they sell more. And, you know, five Security Council veto power-wielding nations, including ourselves, are five biggest arms dealers in the world, and we wonder why we don't have peace. Well, that would be bad for business, wouldn't it? So that's it. So that those two, and then delusion is magnified. The delusion is magnified by propaganda, you know, by media. We love media, actually. In California, we have Hollywood, etc. But media is unfortunately pretty much constrained into propaganda, giving us unrealistic view of life, and you know, making us discontented. Right? You turn on TV, and you get nowadays. Half an hour show, you get like 11 minutes maybe of commercials, which make you feel discontented. So you thought you were happy with your old jalopy or your old jacket or your shoe, and then pretty soon even your old body. And then after a few commercials, oh no, it's no good, I have to have another one. And then you switch to news, And then, you know, they show you some terrorists and a few murders and some auto accidents. And then you feel paranoid and frightened. So discontentment and fear pervades you. So therefore, you tolerate the other stuff. Okay. So, I mean, I'm just drawing a picture, which is, I think you all recognize. And hopefully some of us are less bothered by it than others if we practice some kind of mindfulness or whatever, or do some Dharma practice or something, or some other altruistic thing. But basically, that's the world situation, is pretty much like that. And in so-called underdeveloped countries, they're eager to get into the same level of misery that we have. Mental misery instead of physical misery. So what is the gift of the Tibetans? The Tibetans themselves do not claim that they originated the knowledge that they bring to the world. Ironically, in this situation where they have been completely wiped out in their own country, and their country is kind of a giant gulag, actually. It's a kind of prison camp but there have been various moments. In the 80s, there were some freer moments. But since 94, it's been pretty much locked down, and especially since 2008, when there was basically a mostly nonviolent rebellion throughout all of the Tibetan plateau. The Chinese have locked down Tibet 100%. I met a woman today at the Mindfulness and Compassion Conference over in San Francisco who was in tears telling me about her trip to Tibet in 2012 and how completely oppressed, and her grandmother was in the Holocaust in Germany. And she was just in tears to see that this is happening today. She really was. And anyway, so the Tibetans, that has happened to them, and yet there are Tibetan centers all over the world, thousands of them. Many people have learned something that has improved their lives from them. I think their cultural influence will be felt much more widely. And what is the source of that cultural influence? Some of you may be familiar with Arnold Toynbee, great British historian, who wrote 12-volume Study of History. And then he has a summary of that I recommend if anybody has not looked at that, called Mankind and Mother Earth, which is a one-volume summary, sort of popular written text. And in that, he elaborates a concept that came from earlier historians called the Axial Age. And the Axial Age is around the middle of the first millennium before the Common Era, or BC, as we'd say in some quarters. In religious studies, we say before the Common Era, BCE. And in that period of time, you have the pre-Socratics coming down to the Platonic Academy. You have the Deutero-Isaiah, who collected the Talmud and the Old Testament, the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament. You have Zoroaster in Iran. You have the Upanishadic sages in India and the Buddha and Mahavira of the Jains. You have Confucius and Lao Tzu in China. So all of Eurasia, there is a similar movement that happens. And this movement, teachings are given at that time that shape all of those different cultural streams indelibly. And so, for example, if you go to Columbia or Harvard or Stanford or UC Berkeley or anything, and the wonderful Jerry Brown's dad created California system, you are part of a culture that comes from the Judaic culture and from the Greek culture. And still, the ideals of those cultures we sort of are educated to try to live up to. I was walking with my friend in San Francisco today. We looked at a middle school, and it said, "No man ever does anything as great except that they conquer themselves." Plato. And that was so great, because that's like a Buddhist statement. It's the same statement, actually. That Buddha's whole thing was, if you want to do something in life that's really great, you have to conquer yourself. Conquering others is a complete waste of time, boring, they really don't like it, and it's unsatisfying to you. And which is the counter proposition. And so that was that. Confucius did the same kind of thing. And Lao Tzu, in a little different way, was a little more of a dropout, a little more of a hippie than Confucius was. But they basically said the same thing. Zoroaster, similar things in the Iranian stream. And the Jews, and they were a similar thing in the Judaic stream. And so, really, the sort of trends of all of the main Eurasian streams of culture, which dominate the world today, which was very beautifully analyzed by Jared Diamond in his wonderful book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, about that. They were formed in the Axial Age. And then Toynbee says, and Toynbee was in no way any kind of a Buddhist, but Toynbee says that of all those Axial Age great teachers who founded these great movements that still dominate the cultures, all the cultures in which they happen, of them, the Buddha was the most successful. And he doesn't do it because of some sort of religious superiority or any other thing. The reason he was is that India, he doesn't put it like this, but India was the wealthiest of the Eurasian cultures 2,500 years ago. I put it this way, which is very appropriate here in this audience. India was the California of Eurasia 2,500 years ago. The women were stronger, that means, and therefore the men were happier. You know, they didn't have to poke around under the bed looking for the hairbrushes, but they were more cheerful. Where the men are dominating, they're miserable. They get bad food, they get bad sex, they don't get it even, and then therefore they go out and kill each other because they're so frustrated. And so they live in these backward cultures where women are crushed down and then men are miserable and violent and it's really horrible. So, but India was way ahead of all the others. It was no way perfect. There were a lot of chauvinists. There was still the male patriarchal family and so forth in India's system. But they tolerated a critic of that, a challenger to that, which was the Buddha. But he, it's the same challenging way that the pre-Socratics were doing, that the Lao Tzu was doing, etc. Same way in which this was challenged. But he got away with more of it. You know, Confucius never got tenure because the Chinese were poorer. And the rulers didn't tolerate people dropping out and going off to some Zen center or some Dharma center. They didn't tolerate it. And similarly, the Greeks, Socrates was given a henlock milkshake, remember? Why? For talking to the football team against Sparta, you know, and telling them they should think philosophically rather than might makes right, right? He was already getting them to question. So he was corrupting the youth, that means. That means corrupting the troops. We still see that going on today among certain people in our country even. You know, liberal academia. Liberals have become a bad word in our over-militarized, completely hysterically propagandized country since about 30 years now. And therefore, Toynbee predicted, to everyone's shock, because he was like some British guy, you know, with like a pipe or anything, and a tweed jacket. He wasn't a kind of Dharma person. But he said that the most important event of the 20th century was Western cultures, you know, encounter with Buddhist civilization. That's what he said. And people were like, what? Because, of course, people thought by that he meant some sort of religious thing. Like somehow Buddhism was going to come and convert everybody to Buddhism. And there are some Buddhists who think that, of course. But that's completely not what he meant. Because he doesn't talk about those great founders 2,500 years ago as like some sort of religious fanatic. Some of them did found things that became religions. And you could say that for Buddha, Buddhism is a religion in a way, but actually if you know what Buddhism is, it really isn't a religion. I have a rather a little bit rude way of putting it, so I don't put it this way in every context. But Buddhism is a religion for those people who cannot use the Buddhist educational system, who therefore believe that it's nice and they support the people who are doing it and they think that this will be helpful and they'll get merit. But really, it's an educational system. And what is the proof of that? That's a proof of that is a simple argument. What was Buddha's discovery? Buddha's discovery was nirvana. Some people, like the previous pope, two previous popes, they thought Buddha's discovery was suffering. Oh, and they were really upset about it. They thought, how can anybody think that everything is suffering? Oh, that's so sad. We're so happy we're here in Italy with our Gucci loafers. You know, the popes wear red Gucci loafers, especially made for the pope. And I don't think Francis does. I bet he wears like Buster Brown like the dog. I bet. But the two previous guys did. And so they thought Buddha discovered suffering, but you'd have to be an idiot not to know about suffering. It doesn't take a Buddha or even a semi-intelligent person to discover suffering. All you have to do is stub your toe, or be born, or give birth, and you didn't know about suffering right away. So nobody discovered it. Everybody knew about suffering. What Buddha discovered was freedom from suffering. He actually experienced it. And he said, wow, there's such a thing as nirvana. Whoa, and it is an Indian restaurant in the Central Park South in New York. And nirvana is a restaurant. And I'm sure there may be some out here in California. But the Nirvana Buddha discovered wasn't just a restaurant. It was actually reality. And this is something people forget, because, of course, there is a dualistic version of Buddhism, you know, which says that, well, this world is suffering, and to attain nirvana somewhere else, not this world. You leave this world, you go to nirvana. You know, that's what I call dual. Theravada Buddhism is like that. And the Mahasangika, Theravada, is not the only school, but all of the original dualistic Buddhist school. And dualism just means that there are two realities. There's this world's reality, and there's another reality outside of this world. And you leave this world, you go to nirvana. And that sort of, that can be used as a kind of religious thing. So therefore, do something to leave the world. But that isn't really Buddha's best teaching, because it isn't logical. And Buddha was very logical. If nirvana was somewhere else, it cannot be an absolute state. It cannot be reality. It's just another place. Right? Because if there's a boundary between it and this world, then if you just cross the boundary, and that makes it a relational place. And if there's a state of being in nirvana that's separate from your being here, then it's just a relative state and unreliable, like all other changeable states. So the thing about nirvana is, Buddha said when he was being more logical, he said to a sort of audience that could kind of take it, he said, nirvana is reality itself and always has been. And therefore, you don't enter it, actually. You discover that you've always been in it, is what you discover. So that's a strange thing to say. That means that if we're not free of suffering right now, if we're not in bliss right now, and you're in California, so you're close. Except for a little water problem, but otherwise you're close. But if we're not aware of that, that means we're not aware of reality. We're stuck in an unreality. We're stuck in a delusion. And we think it's like the Matrix, you know? It's like we think this is the real thing here, where we are. And then we think, and each person here is the real thing. You each person think, I think so. I'm Bob Thurman, I'm really Bob Thurman. And you would think you're the real thing, each one of you, right? And therefore, each one of us has a terrible predicament. Then, because we each think we are the real thing about ourselves, right? Then we sort of sneakily think we are a little more important than any other real thing around there, because we're not sure if they're the real thing. We know we are, right? And then the third step on that one is we're a little paranoid and dissatisfied about it, because they don't treat us like the more important real thing. Which one of us has the mom thought we were more important for a short time? During the mother's gold period, we could call it. And if you're in love with somebody and they're in love with you, then they think you're the real thing for a short time. And they hope you think they're the real thing. And if both of you think each the other one is the real thing, that's why everybody else can hate the two of you and you get done in like Romeo and Juliet. So the point is that if we think we're the real thing and everything else is really different, we are overwhelmed by our struggle with the universe and by the universe's failure to appreciate how real we really are. Isn't that that's so simple? And it's not even complicated. It's really simple. So Buddha's discovery was, wow, the real thing is this total interwoven web of life with no limit. And in a way, really, there's no other being really. Unreally, yeah, there's kind of sort of other, we have to be responsible for ourselves and this and that, but there's no absolute difference between us and any other. We're all interconnected completely, 100%. Not just us, all humans, all animals, even plants, the planet, everything is totally interconnected. And somehow, and this is of course hard to believe even, because we're so used to being miserably isolated and all alone and struggling against life and death and sickness and the world and so on. But unbelievably, if we realize that we are really all of it, really, then somehow that really cheers us up. You'd think it would. In Shanti Deva's famous book, there's a thing like, ooh, I don't want to be everybody. I hate having one headache myself. What if I was everybody else and had all of their headaches? That would be terrible. But apparently, when you really realize you're everybody else, you don't have a headache. I don't know why. I'm hoping it's true. I don't pretend to be enlightened and have discovered it, but I will admit to having a very strong idea about it, actually, I must admit. My wife scolded me recently about how I always intensively deny how I'm enlightened, which I do, especially around the house, or I'd be in real trouble. But she said, no, yeah, but you, that's correct, you're an idiot, but, in a way, you are more enlightened than most people, so it would discourage them too much if you keep insisting how unenlightened you are. So shut up and admit to it. A bit of enlightenment. So I have that license now. I do. Like, but I'm not that enlightened. 48 years we've been married, and I have not yet been accepted as a disciple. I'm still an aspirant, you know, like in the Zen Center where you sit out in the mud and the rain and you see the temple. I'm in that state. But I have shown improvement. I'm near the door now. After 48 years, you know. And probably 48 lifetimes, I would say even. So therefore, Buddhism is based on a really cheery idea, which is that reality is bliss. It's nirvana, it's truth. And he never said bliss right away. Don't say bliss, no. Because people get suspicious. As you all know. But you're better off here in California than in the East. But, you know, bliss or real happiness, sort of random happiness, that bumper sticker of random happiness for no reason, it's always illegal. It's not only suspect, it's illegal, usually. Like your mate or your roommate or your kid or your parent, they come home someday and say, I'm so happy, I don't know why. And what do? You give them, like, some drug, you know, to get a downer, they're on a manic cycle, what's going to happen to them, they'll kill themselves tomorrow, what did they drink, what did they take, it's, right? You're suspected. So he didn't say bliss, he just said freedom from suffering. But that's bliss. Come on. He later filled in, it's bliss. So reality is bliss. So suffering is unreal. And why is that good? Because reality will always eventually overwhelm unreality, right? Unreality is not real, so therefore it's less strong than reality. Do you follow me? So that means ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance is suffering. And wisdom is bliss. Breaking past the ignorance and understanding what is real. So that means, therefore, the more that you understand about reality, the happier you are. The less you live in denial, the happier you are. Denial makes you more unhappy. You think, oh, that's fine. I won't think about death. Not me. I'm American. We just zip them up in a bag and we shuffle them up to the heavenly rest, you know. And then either God takes care of them or they don't exist. So therefore, at least they have anesthesia. And I don't know, that future life, I don't believe that crap. That's some weird thing from Asia. And I'm a secular Buddhist to hear this absolute rot from some people. And meanwhile, nobody gets out of here a day. That's a Tibetan slogan. Nobody's going to get out of here just by dying. That's ridiculous. If that was the case, why would people go to Zen centers and sit there staring at the wall and get all uncomfortable and have like pains in their back and hips and knees and butt? They just shoot themselves. Really quick and like, bam, they don't exist. But people don't do that unless they're really confused, because everyone's senses and everything everyone in life has ever experienced is continuity. Nobody has ever seen something become nothing. Those scientists at MIT and Harvard, they tell you, oh yeah, we know that. Future life? No, no, it's just your brain. You're just a brain. There's nothing else but your brain. That guy who had a proof of heaven, Evan Alexander, they hate him, he was a neuroscientist. His brain was flatlined for like half a day. And he was all marching around heaven. Then he came back, oh, he's really bad. He's a traitor. Why? I like to ask you this question. Who can prove that there's going to be nothing after death. Who has the proof of that? Who reported back? Hey guys, I'm nothing now, so it's cool. Just die if you get embarrassed or if something goes wrong, because you're just going to be nothing, so at least it can't be worse than anesthesia. Who reported back on that one? And who is ever going to report back on that one? Nobody, obviously. Those guys, they think they discovered nothing, and they want a prize. They want to get a science prize.
We discovered nothing. All that other stuff was religion scaring people
out of Sunday contributions in the plate.
Oh, in future life, you need to worry.
You do need to worry. Just like you worry about the future, your pension, especially in America, where they'll confiscate your pension. They can, it's a greater. But you do worry about it, and you should. It's practical. You can be in the moment and worry about the future without being really too freaked out, as long as Eckhart Tolle doesn't catch you. But you think that's practical and normal. And then a little worrying about the future life is also really important. People who worried about the future life, they didn't make nuclear bombs to destroy the planet. They are not ignoring the needs of their grandchildren and children, because they might be their own grandchildren and great-grandchildren. They are aware of that. And so they kind of, that gives you a certain hesitancy about going all the way to the max, you know. The nihilist person is very reckless, because they think the worst thing that can happen to them is just a quick boom and they're gone. But you know what? Every one of us has fallen asleep every night, some of us for many years. And when we did, we were tired and worked hard. It was a really great thing. We didn't sit around and say, oh, I don't want to lose consciousness and be unconscious and go into the oblivion and deep sleep. Oh, no, no, no. We didn't sit there. We said, oh, thank goodness, bam. But what happens? We get thrown up into a dream. We have to wake up the next day. It's a big pain. You know, we don't stay unconscious. So we've had that experience of disappointment many times. I know you all wake up really fresh and happy and cheerful.
Not really, right?
Especially when the alarm goes off and you have to go to work and so on. You know, the mass of people who have heart attacks, type A personalities, who are working for nothing but money and they feel there's no meaning in their life. You know when they have a heart attack? 8:30 a.m. Monday morning. That's when the majority of heart attacks and strokes occur. But people like that. So what is the gift of the Tibetans? Is ancient India had a more full Socratic, Isaic, Confucian, Taoist moment with a bigger literature. You know, instead of just the dialogues of Plato, they had like 50-100 dialogues of Plato. The entire, there's a figure that the entire number of codices that are the root manuscripts in Aramaic, Egyptian, Greek, that give us what the idea of classical culture was, that we Roman and Latvia, Roman and Greek and Judaic and Egyptian culture, that, you know, our Western stream is based on, is approximately 30,000 codices. The parallel body of ancient manuscripts in India is 3 million and counting, just like the population of India, so huge even now. And, you know, India is actually much bigger than China. It seems to be about the same size as China, 1.2 billion. India, because the British carved off Bengal and Sindh, you know, Baluchistan, what they call Pakistan, which is really India. But if those were added in, India is almost 2 billion. It's the biggest country in the world, except for the British division. And so they were then also much bigger, many more Athenses. They had like 20 Athenses, you know, 20 libraries of Alexandria, this kind of thing, right? And that was a great knowledge, and they weren't perfect, and they had problems, but they were better with their women, basically. They were better with their language. They was, you know, people often ask me, why do you like so much the Eastern Indian and Tibetan cultures, and why do you like that? You were brought to New York, you went to Phillips Exeter, Harvard, really, all this, and how come you ran out there? You know, what's the matter with you? And I love to annoy them nowadays. I used to say something about spiritual, but I don't. I say, I was looking for a sane alphabet. When I grew up, I didn't like the crazy alphabet. Did you ever really reflect? You all learned, you know,
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
What is the rhyme or reason of that ordering of sounds? Can anybody tell me? A, B, C. A is not A, it's A. B is a consonant. A is a vowel. C is never C, it's usually cat. Ha. I mean, what is with that alphabet? Who cooked it? And how smart were they really, you know? Sanskrit alphabet is all organized, which then comes down to Hindi and Tibetan and other languages, modern languages. It's all organized linguistically. It's generated. Linguistics as a science was invented by Russian and German scholars when they discovered Sanskrit in the 18th century. And the British climbed in later with their empire. But the idea that, did you ever think about it? Try to make the sound of a consonant without a vowel. Say a consonant without a vowel. Try to say B. You go, all you can do is go. A consonant is just a position of the lips, teeth, tongue, and it's a position from which a vowel makes a sound. And there are some, in some, but there I won't do it. So I never heard that. Harvard, well, they have an idea about that. Excellent, what's that? This blah, blah, blah. You talk in ABCD, you learn that, so shut up. So that's what I say. However, in 1,000 years ago, and they had medicine, really excellent. They had all kind of, and they considered that the most important science, nowadays in America, we have the mindfulness craze. I'm here also at a conference over at San Francisco State, where they're having a conference called Mindfulness and Compassion. A lot of you practice mindfulness meditation, have you, some of you? Anybody done mindfulness? Hands or hands? Yeah, a little bit of that. Great. So you're happier than other people. No, you are. You were a little unhappy. Because you looked at, what is going on in my mind? Whoa, there's like five extra channels that I don't even like that. ABC, NBC, it's all churning around in my mind. My grandfather's there, my father. I have Walter Cronkite in there. You older people know what I'm talking about. Voice of reality, that's Walter Cronkite. When we used to have news. And so when you first do mindfulness, you get a little nervous because you realize there's a whole cacophony going on inside your mind. But then once you get to see it, and you can move around, you develop a little bit of critical awareness, and you can change channels. You have like a clicker. You finally get a clicker in your own mind, and you can shift from one channel to another. When one voice inside your mind says, I should be really mad, that person said, blah, 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 and all your adrenaline and your cortisol is flowing, and you feel like horrible. And when you do that, you come and say, no, that's not so bad. What am I doing? You look at it in another angle, get a different perspective on it. And you can be more free in your reactivity, right? I don't see that lady with the white, blonde hair, right? You did mindfulness, I can see that. So you're a little freer about your reactions, right? When Uncle Joe presses your button, you can either react or not react, because you're not a victim of that button. You can shift from it. That's why mindfulness is a minor, but important, but it's a minor technique developed by centuries of mind science. Because in ancient India, Buddhist, Hindu, doesn't matter, Jain, all of them realized that the most important thing about your life is your mind and your own ability to master your mind. Because you can be in the best environment, really everything should be happy and great, and something bothers you emotionally and you're miserable, right? Like the guy who's angry, his beloved little baby girl comes in saying, hi, daddy, you know, get out of my face. Because their anger makes them unable to appreciate something. Because they're reacting, they're trapped by some involuntary reaction. And they choose to go with that. Mindfulness gives you much bigger range of choice and gives you an ability to kind of create gaps in your reaction so you can choose to move this way or that way. It's really, really important. Nowadays, my wife is a fanatic devotee of Korean soap operas. South Korean soap operas. There's like 100 Downton Abbeys going on there. No, really, they're really fantastic. If you have Roku and you ever watch Drama Fever, you can watch these great things. And one of the things that's a main theme in those soap operas, I don't know how they got to that idea, because They're not Buddhists really anymore, but their culture is shaped by it. But now a lot of them have become Protestants, evangelists. The Catholics are so freaked out. I was once met them and they said, "What happened? We were there for centuries and we got like 3 converts. And those Baptists showed up after the Korean War. Boom, they all went rushing off to Christianity." But I like that they did that, frankly. I'm not like a fanatic Buddhist. Because, you know, their notion of Buddhism was like some Zen guy looking really grumpy. And then they had, you know, little baby Jesus. I mean, poor Jesus when he's going through his hard time, which the Romans inflicted on us as symbol of Jesus, is like maybe not so cheery. But little baby Jesus is cute. I mean, he's nice. He says, "Be nice, turn the other cheek, don't do all this nasty stuff." It's very cool. So it's kind of like the sweetness of our Kuan Yin, you know, Avalokiteshvara. It's all in the same bag with Jesus. So I think it's great. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that one thing that all the bad guys always say in the Korean soap operas is, "That's the way the world is. You know, if I don't do it, another person will do it." And then they do some horrible, nasty thing like this, assassinate somebody. And that's the normal one. "You're an idiot if you don't think so." And the good guys, they say, "No, you can't make an excuse that that's politics or that's the way it is. You can't do that. Actually, you did what you did because you chose to do it. And you could choose to do something better and change your work. You could do that." So that's sort of the key thread that runs through all those so far. They're really cool. If you don't have Roku and if you ever want to watch them, they have some of them have 80 episodes. And my wife has watched 4 of them. And I wish I could, but I've watched about 30 or 40 in between. And I don't get my work done. So great.
Thank you for listening to the Bob Thurman podcast. Please tune in next week to hear the second half of this recording.